and definition of science and religion. We try to see if it all works. So you were supposed to have looked at this, and I found this topic very interesting, because usually we think of science as coming about just by use of our intelligence, and we look at religion as based on faith. In other words, science is completely reasonable, and religion is not really reasonable, it's just that people believe it. But we're going to have fun with that concept. Now, just below, maybe you can just go up a bit, Kotipu, that here's some definitions of science. I picked the most suitable ones for this particular purpose. I just got them basically off the internet, though, off the different dictionaries on the internet. So science is knowing. Knowledge as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding. So it's really knowing. This is what science is. This is what people call science. And then, second one, science makes use of the scientific method, which includes the careful observation of natural phenomena, the formulation of hypothesis, the conducting of one or more experiments to test the hypothesis, and the drawing of a conclusion that confirms or modifies the hypothesis. So they're saying that science is tested very thoroughly. You have your hypothesis or your theory, but it's not really accepted until it's tested and proven and experimented. Then, science is the systematic study of the nature and behavior of the material and physical universe, based on observation, experiment, measurement, and the formulations of laws to describe these facts in general terms. So great experiments, and we've observed these things. And then knowledge, especially, that science is knowledge gained through experience. And then go on to the definitions of religion. Very, very different what religion, how religion is defined. The service and worship of God or the supernatural. In other words, you can't observe it, you can't test it, you can't theorize, you can't experiment. And commitment or devotion to religious faith or observance. So it's not based on necessarily truth, but you have a commitment to it. Whether it's true or not is more or less irrelevant. And the third one, a cause, a principle, activity, or a system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith. That means I believe this, and I don't care about what you think, or I don't care what science says. I strongly believe it. Or an activity pursued with zeal or conscientious devotion. I believe it. I'm going to do it. And then finally, belief in and reverence for a supernatural power or powers. It all has to do with belief. Not fact, not provable, but belief, faith, and then holding to it regardless of what else the world says. That's how religion is thought of. Belief in and reverence for a supernatural power or powers regarded as a creator and governor of the universe. So religion has to do, by these definitions, with belief and faith and science with what's true. You can see it. You can observe it. You can test it. Very different from the faithfulness of the religious believers. Okay, there's some other quotations, but since we're running late, there's Stephen Hawking. Do you know Stephen Hawking? He's a very famous person. but I didn't put a picture of him there because it's not very pleasant to see his picture because he has so many physical problems. It's quite amazing that he's so brilliant despite his physical incapacity. And then everyone knows the next one. He's quite the atheist. And the next person, we have these quotes. It's interesting that he, if you go up a little bit, a little up the other way. Nope. Yes, thank you. He says, God not only plays dice, he sometimes throws the dice where they cannot be seen. Of course, he just doesn't really believe in God in that sense. He's just saying that things just happen basically with the certainty that we throw dice, that in other words, anything can happen basically, and this is just what happened. That's basically what he believes. He's not a theistical person. And then Albert Einstein is still more famous for his theory of relativity and so many things. He's much more humble, but he has a different type of religious view. He sees, and actually it's just, interestingly enough, his vision is basically described in the Bhagavad Gita in the seventh chapter, Bhudha Vishwa something, that he sees the universe. And these scientists come to see this, and so do astrologers too. They come to see this universe as an interconnected organism. But he sees the elements of this, Albert Einstein, more or less, as he'll call that God. But he's not a theist in the same way. He doesn't believe that there's a person behind it. This is a very interesting point, but he's humble. Read this first quote up here by Albert Einstein. I see a pattern, but my imagination cannot picture the maker of that pattern. It's there, but how could I, with my brain, my own capacity, even though it's one of the most brilliant persons who ever existed, practically, I can't perceive who created this pattern. Well, that makes sense. That's like if we buy some basmati rice from where? Dehradun or Pakistan or something. So you can know something about the rice, you can see how it's grown, but can you say anything about the farmer? What his life is like? What his family is like? What his trials are like? What are the difficulties of his life? No, you can't. You can see the patterns, that which is common, but you can't know the personality of the person who took part in the growing of that rice. So he says, I see a clock, but I cannot envision the clockmaker. The human mind is unable to conceive of the four dimensions, so how can it conceive of a God before whom 1,000 years and 1,000 dimensions are as one? So this infinite supreme Lord, how are we going to say he's there? How can we talk about who he is? Really, by the power of our own brain, the power of our own intelligence, we can't really enter into discussions about who he is and what he does and what his nature is any more than you can understand the nature of the clockmaker or the watchmaker and the person when you look at your watch or when you look at your basmati rice or the atta that you've grown. You can't know who the farmer is and what his life is like. Okay, why don't we close this one? And now there's another, let's see, not the Bhagavad Gita one. What is it, the bottom one say? The Rise of Life. We're going to look at this. Now, this little section comes from a book by someone by the name of Bill Bryson. It's called, the book is A Short History of Nearly Everything. Have any of you heard of this book? It's very, very, very famous. Sorry. But it is famous, despite the fact that no one has ever heard of it here. And there's thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of copies in print, and it's often quoted. And what this person isn't a scientist, but he's decided he wants to know what's going on in the scientific community. And in a very popular way, he's presenting scientific truths and scientific facts, but he's presenting it the same points that the scientists are making, and they're quite leaning towards atheism, but he's writing it in a very clever way, acute way, so that ordinary people can understand these scientific truths. Now, the two points that I thought were most amazing, and you'll see why I mean by calling them amazing, is where does life come from? So he's going to explain, for all of you who want to know, who believe in science, no, don't go yet, who believe in science. What does science mean again? Experiment. What else? Testing. What else? Hypothesis. What else? Observation. Truth. It's what's there. It's facts. As opposed to religion is just what you believe and have faith in. So he's going to speak about where life comes from, which is, of course, a very interesting question. From the point of view of science, the point of view of facts, not faith, but facts. And this is what he writes. Now, again, he writes in a cute way, cute meaning a way that we're supposed to be able to relate to it, not in a technical way. Now, what I've done is I've put his words in exactly as he wrote them in this section, but I've added some pictures that I got from the internet, just simple pictures that I got from the internet. So the words are his, and the photographs or the pictures, I wouldn't say they're mine because I didn't take them, but at least I bootlegged them from the internet. So that's not what he wrote, but that's what I added. Okay, so this is how he begins. The rise of life. Proteins are what you get when you string amino acids together. Any, have you studied science, most of you? You have science background? Raise your hand if you have science background. Okay. Proteins are what you get when you string... And everyone else can just go to sleep. That's all right. Proteins are what you get when you string... But it's so funny. You won't be able to sleep, I imagine. Or what you get when you string amino acids together. And we need a lot of them. No one really knows, but there may be as many as a million types of proteins in the human body. And each one is a little miracle. Okay. By all the laws of probability, proteins shouldn't exist. Because where do proteins come from? A combination of amino acids. To make a protein, you need to assemble amino acids in a particular order, in much the same way that you assemble letters in a particular order to spell a word. The problem is that words in the amino acid alphabet are often exceedingly long. To spell collagen, the name of a common type of protein, you need to arrange 8 letters in the right order. But to make collagen, this particular protein, you need to arrange 1,055 amino acids in precisely the right sequence. But, and here's an obvious but crucial point, go up a little bit, you don't make it. It makes itself. Spontaneously, without direction. And this is where the unlikelihood comes in. Now he's putting, this is a person who's gotten all his information from the scientists, taking it from an atheistical point of view, saying that life just spontaneously generates somehow or another. And this is what he's written. The chance of a 1,055 sequence molecule like collagen spontaneously self-assembling are, frankly, nil. It can't happen. It just isn't going to happen. To grasp what a long shot its existence is, visualize a standard Las Vegas slot machine, but don't really go and visualize it, by the way. Or they call these in the United States slot machines. What do they call them in Australia? I don't know. I didn't expect anyone to even know. But it's the same concept. We're going to tell your mothers on you later. So envision that. Go ahead. Go up a little more. But broaden greatly to about 90 feet instead of a usual pokey is how long? It's big maybe? I don't know. I've never seen one myself. But instead of being about this big, 90 feet to be precise, to accommodate 1,055 spinning wheels instead of the usual 3 or 4. But with 20 symbols on each wheel for each common amino acid. So to assemble this, these 1,055 out of each wheel has how many? 20? 20 different things. Now how many times would you have to pull the lever to expect to get this amino acid? How long would you have to pull the handle before all 1,055 symbols came up in the right order? Effectively, forever. And even if you reduce the number of spinning wheels to 200, which is actually a more typical number of amino acids for a protein, the odds against all 200 coming up in a prescribed sequence are 1 in 10,260. That's 1 followed by 260 zeros, which comes to... And this is only part of the problem of the theory of that life just spontaneously generates. And that number in itself is a larger number than all the atoms in the universe. And these are the scientists. Proteins, in short, are complex entities. Thank you. For random events to produce even a single protein would be a stunning improbability. Like a whirlwind. Koti, up a little bit. Like a whirlwind spinning through a junkyard and leaving behind a fully assembled jumbled jet, in the colorful simile of astronomer Fred Hoare. Do you think that's likely, or would you like to bet your paycheck on it that it might happen? It just isn't going to happen. But there's more. Okay. Yet, we are talking about several hundred thousand types of protein. So this is just one is completely unlikely to assemble. But to make in a human body, there's hundred thousand types of proteins, perhaps a million, each unique and each, as far as we know, vital to the maintenance of a sound and happy you. And it goes on from there. The improbability just increases. A protein to be of use must not only assemble amino acids in the right sequence, but then it must engage in a kind of chemical origami and fold itself into a very special shape. Because the shape of the amino acids that they fold into determine what kind of protein it is. And even having achieved this structural complexity, a protein is no good to you if it can't reproduce itself. And proteins can't. So the odds or the probability of life coming, arising from matter, first problem is that the protein has to be the amino acids have to come into proteins, and the odds are almost impossible. And then the second problem is they have to reproduce themselves, because if you create one protein and then it's finished, it can't reproduce, then where's the life going to come from? So it has to reproduce itself, and for that you need DNA. DNA is a whiz at replicating. It can make a copy of itself in seconds, but can do virtually nothing else. So we have a paradoxical situation. Proteins can't exist without DNA, and DNA has no purpose without proteins. So which one came first? And DNA is, it has to have the ability to reproduce, duplicate the proteins, but it has no function unless the protein is already there, and it's already complicated. And if the protein is there but no DNA, then it's not going to arise. Nothing is going to arise from that. So how do you coordinate this type of a thing? Proteins can't exist without DNA, and DNA has no purpose without proteins. Are we to assume that they arose simultaneously with the purpose of supporting each other? This is not the theory of evolution. This is the theory of design, practically speaking. If so, if they did it like that, wow, very improbable. And there's still more unlikelihood. DNA proteins and other components of life couldn't prosper without some sort of membrane to contain them. No atom or molecule has ever achieved life independently. Pluck any atom from your body. You can do that as you want. If you want to be a true scientist, you can start your atom plucking right now. And it is no more alive than a grain of sand. It is only when they come together within the nurturing refuge of a cell that these diverse materials can take part in the amazing dance that we call life. So you need the proteins, impossible to put together, and then you need the RNA, impossible to come at the same time, and then you have to have encapsulated them in a cell membrane. And yet, these people, they don't even call it the theory of evolution. If you talk to your teachers when you were in school and told them, that is evolution a theory or a fact? If you tried to tell them it was a theory, they get so upset because it's their religion, actually. That's the problem. They hold to these beliefs. They've placed themselves, their beliefs, on the line in these things. This, I say, is not science. They believe it. And, okay, we'll finish and then we'll ask the question the prophet asked. So without the cell, they are nothing more than interesting chemicals. But without the chemicals, the cell has no purpose. As the physicist Paul Davies puts it, if everything needs everything else, how did the community of molecules ever arise in the first place? How? Very unlikely. It is rather as if all the ingredients in your kitchen somehow got together and baked themselves into a cake. All on their own. And not only that, but a cake that could moreover divide when necessary to produce more cakes. This is what he's written. It is little wonder, and not only that, then it produces so many varieties of cakes. It is little wonder that we call it the miracle of life. Now, is this talking, does that sound like science to you? Whose side is he on anyway? It is also little wonder that we have barely begun to understand it. The end. There's more that he says too, but tomorrow we'll read a little bit more of a different topic. But there's other wild things that come out. And he's big. He's well known. He's respected. The reality is, as you can see from this, regardless of what the scientists say, that they have no idea where life comes from. And when they say, well, it's just a chance combination of chemicals, what would Prabhupada say? What was Prabhupada's reply to that? Well, if we give you the chemicals, could you do it? Here are the chemicals. Would you make life, please? And then we'll give you some credibility if you can make life just from chemicals. And then you have the right to not call it a theory, but you can call it science. And then you have a right to not call it your personal belief, but then you can call it science. Facts, observable. So up to this point, it's not really, we can't say it's true. It's someone's idea. It's someone's idea of where life came from. But we will say, now, Koti, maybe you can close it now, that it is not the idea of Krishna. Now, if it goes on again, yeah, we need to open up another PDF. the one that says Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2. Now here is a different point of view than the scientist's point of view of the origin of life. We'll read several verses from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Does everyone have that? We haven't given it. Okay. Is it working? Is this have both? Oh, this is the second chapter one. Okay. So you can look along. Just a few verses. So it's very difficult to go against your education, because what we learn or taught when we're young tends to be what we believe. Whether it's true or not, this is what we were taught. And in that sense, that life comes from matter is much more like religion than science, because this is what we were taught. Raise your hand if when you were growing up you were taught evolution in school. I was. Was anyone not taught evolution in school? Were you taught it as this is one idea of how it may be, or were you taught this is what happened? But this is, well then why don't you do it and then we'll believe you? Why don't you just create life from chemicals? So there is a particular type of, I would say, brainwashing that goes on. Now, we'll speak more about the repercussions or the ramifications of this theory as opposed to what Krishna is going to say in a few moments. But first, we want to just keep this point in mind, or please keep this point in mind, that there is science, and then there is religion. And they say that science is fact, basically, based on reason, and religion is based on belief and faith. Now, did you see anything in there that specifically was that you didn't have to have a lot of faith to believe? Wasn't based on thesis and experimentation and adjustment. And again, this isn't, I put the photos in there just to illustrate it, but this is what is believed, and this is how it's presented. Now here, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is going to explain a completely different vision about life. He's going to give knowledge. The scientists say we are giving knowledge, but they're giving, in my humble opinion, belief. And here, Krishna, who is, we accept certainly as the greatest authority, is going to give knowledge. And knowledge is so important because we base our life is based on knowledge. And Prabhupada even said that religion without science is just a sentiment. Without knowledge is just a sentiment. So here's what Krishna says. First, this is the 11th verse. Please repeat after me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Asochanan Vasochastvam Pragyavadams to Bashise Gatasun Nagatasum Cha Nanu So Chanti Panditaha. Because this is practically the first instruction that Krishna gives to Arjuna, and his instruction is because Arjuna doesn't want to fight in the battle, because he sees that there's so much killing that's going to take place and so much life is going to be lost. And he doesn't want to be responsible for it. And what Krishna does is give him this knowledge which will change his perspective on life, on what should be done and what should not be done, on what is important and what is not important. Like when one is like a 7-year-old child or something, if you say, how long is this going to go on? How long is he going to keep talking about these science things and philosophy? And he said, just wait 5 minutes. A 7-year-old, he can't conceive of what 5 minutes is even. He doesn't have the conceptual capacity. And what a 7-year-old might think is most important, like, what does a 7-year-old think is most important? Huh? Playing and having a sweet. Some of us are a little bit like 7-year-olds, I have to admit it, but that's important. But thinking about the consequence of my life, what should I do with my life? It's beyond the capacity of a 7-year-old, and it's not to be thrown on a 7-year-old either, because they simply don't have the capacity. But according to one's knowledge, one's frame of reference, we judge how to live our life. If we think that life just somehow comes from matter, then it's just chemicals, and then after the body dies, the lights go out, and it's over, then that affects the way we live our life and what we think is important or not. But if we take Krishna's words, when you go up a little bit more so we can just see that again. He tells Arjuna a little bit more. He said, Asochanan Vishochas Twam. You are lamenting for things that are not actually worthy of lamentation. Now this is a heavy statement because he's talking about the death of the Kurus. Krishna is saying, you're not seeing it from the right perspective. Pragyavaram Subhasa say, although you are speaking as if you are learned, learned people don't say what you say. Gatasana Gatasanascha Nanu Sochati Pandita. The learned persons do not lament for what you are lamenting for. Now, just consider this point that Krishna is making. That we, and he's going to say it more clearly later, that we are eternal. We are souls. We are not the body. We are not protein molecules composed of amino acids and circled by a cell membrane with RNA duplicating it. No, Krishna is saying we are eternal. Now, if we actually realized, accepted that, how would that change the way we live our life? I think very deeply, if we actually were committed to this point, that I'm actually eternal. I see the tendency to think myself the body, to think this is me. It is so strong. It is so strong. But how would my consciousness and what I think is important and not important, how would it change if I saw myself as eternal? So Krishna first is chastising Arjuna, and here we've put in a picture that is actually of all people preaching. That's Yamaraj and the queens of a king, Suyagya, who's been killed on the battlefield. They're all lamenting. And Yamaraj comes to him in the form of a young boy. Does anyone know who speaks this little story? Hiranyakashipu, of all people. Hiranyakashipu, an asura. But yet he knows, even he knows this. Yamaraj tells the queens that you're worrying about the fact that he's gone and you have no idea when you're going to go. when we were coming here, the reason why we're so delayed, there we were minding our own business yesterday. We took off in our Qantas flight, and just as after we took off, a flock of birds flew into the engine of Galaz, the beautiful white and reddish birds. And the whole plane started really shaking and everything like that. And it was a bit frightening, but and they eventually turned back and everything. But it could have been the end. And what was my consciousness focused on? And what will happen to me? Where will I go when the plane drops in its altitude and there's terror and everyone starts screaming and terror is in my mind and everyone else's mind? What will I hold on to for security? Where is my real life? Will I quickly see how my credit cards are doing? And is that going to help me? Because it said, actually, that studies on this, when people feel themselves in danger, the first thing they do is count their money. Really, that's the first thing people do. They count and see how much money they have. As if the plane is falling into the ocean, and if I have $10 or $1,000, it's going to make any difference. I don't know when I'm going to die. I'm eternal. What's life's purpose? That's what Krishna is saying here. And that's what Yamaraj is telling these queens. Go on to the next verse. So that was 11. Krishna says then, Natvevaham jatunasam. Everyone, repeat after me. Natvevaham jatunasam. I feel like I'm in Bombay traffic or something like that. We'll try it again. I'll read one line and then everyone repeat it after me. Natvevaham jatunasam. Natvam nime jana dipaha. The chayvana bhavishyama. Sarvevayam ataparam. So Krishna says, first, in the previous verse, he told them you're speaking not wise words. And here he says, he just comes out and says it. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. We are all eternal. I have always been Krishna, Krishna is saying. You have always been that person, Arjuna. And all these kings on the battlefield, there was no time, either in the past, the present, or in the future, where they have been anything other than themselves. And Krishna, in this picture from the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna always stays with the soul. He always stays with the soul. So vasya chaham ride sanavisto. Krishna stays with us and wishes that we turn to him sincerely and acknowledge our relationship with him. So do you need faith to do this? Of course. Of course you need faith. But do you need faith to believe that life came from amino acids and proteins? Yes. Okay. And now, all these verses are famous, but this one is. I'll say one line, and you please repeat. Dehenos min yata dehe. Komaram jovaram jara tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatra namuyate. So the embodied soul within a body, dehenos vinyata dehek, he passes in this body from boyhood to youth and then to jara, to old age, or from girlhood to youth, to old age. And don't think that it's not going to happen to you. How old are you? Just curiously. No. 28. And how old are you, since we pointed to you? 34. Okay. Now, when you were 16, either of you, did you ever think you were going to be 34 or 28? Yes, you did think so. You're wise. Wiser than I was. I don't think I thought I was going to get old. I never thought my knees were going to start aching and my teeth would get loose and my hair. I remember it now. I never thought it was going to depart from my body. And my ankle hurts. And you don't really think that this is really going to happen. But yet, all of us experience this. This is actually directly experienced, practically speaking. That you remember yourself at 6 years old. Raise your hand if you can remember yourself at six. Can you, anyone remember their first day of school? That's usually a traumatic experience. Well, I want my mommy, my mother, and they leave me here. So we're there, and it was the same me, the same person, and then I grew up, and I was 8, and then I was 10, and then I was 12, and 16, and then 20, and then 28, and 34. But there is a continuity of identity. There's something, someone, I do not change throughout all these different changes of body. Now, I've seen this myself. You know, now I'm old, and you look in the mirror, and I have a conception of myself as a 16-year-old boy, and I think, who's that? Who's the old man? Well, I could say it's me, but it's not. Actually, it's not. And if I think that the body is me, then I'm in for a lot of trouble in my life, because it's inevitable that this body deteriorates. It's inevitable. So why stake my whole life? Why put all my attention into trying to make this body comfortable when it is doomed? It doesn't make any sense. But that's what we do. That's the tendency of everyone. So therefore, this knowledge is so important, because based on knowledge, we can decide the perspectives and how to allocate our time and decide what we want to do with our life, because we're not going to be here forever. Now it's 2011, and it's already September. 2011. I remember it was just January, and it's gone so fast. And none of us, and practically in the whole world, people who were alive in 100 years ago, in 1911, how many people are alive? So we can understand from that probably in 50, 60, 70, 80 years, where will we be? We won't know exactly. That depends on how we live our life, because we're eternal. This is the point that Krishna is making. And then this picture is a real classic, because we experience it. Boyhood or girlhood. No. Where are you in this? Where is your body in this, what would you call it, a succession of aging bodies? This, Samasunda, point to you where you are. Where are you, Samasunda? Oh, you've gone shy on us. Strong self-concept. Strong. Oh, it's 16. I would say 16 or something. Samson is not quite there yet. But he's strong and big like that, what to speak of intelligent. But wherever we are in this, it's also interesting to ask, how old do you actually think of yourself as? How old? You laugh first. Okay, how old do you think of yourself as? And how old are you? How old is your body? Because there's some us, we don't actually grow older. I won't ask any of the Matajis that question. I get myself in more trouble than I require. But where are we? Mentally, look at this and see where you are. And then, Koti, where are you? And the succession, where are you? Huh? In the middle. Prime, that's... Yeah. I'm laughing at all you, but I won't tell you where I am in that one. It's definitely on the other side. Think of where you are, and then think, well, it's nice to be here now, but how long am I going to be here? It just moves. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. So what, based on this knowledge, Krishna's pointing out to Arjuna, based on this knowledge, how will I decide about what to do with my life? And should I get caught up? Because life is full of so many difficulties. It's one after the next, and you think that as soon as I get rid of this one, then it'll be okay. And then when I get rid of this one, if I get to get rid of this boss and get a new boss and get rid of this and solve my immigration problem or one of this or that or so many things. But it never ends. It simply never ends. Because life in a material body, there's an incompatibility. The eternal soul in a changing body, there's an incompatibility. So how do you deal, based on this knowledge, how do you deal, what do you do about all the comings and goings of our fate, of our karma? And then Krishna explains that in the next verse. But before we go to the next verse, there's a second part of this. That not only do the bodies change, like it's in the upper part over there, going from boyhood to youth to old age and then onward, but then we change to different species of life according to how we've lived our life. If we have animalistic tendencies, then this is expressing our desire. And by the laws of nature, we are placed in an animal species, in that type of body. So how to deal with the difficulties that inevitably come in life? And the next verse, Krishna will explain. Matraspajastukanteya, everyone. Sitosna sukha dukha daha agamapayino anityas tamsta tikshas fabharata. And Krishna says something so amazing, and the last thing that you'd expect in one sense, and the last thing you feel like doing, is to tolerate it. Keep your mind focused in knowledge on what you're going to do with your life based on the fact that I'm an eternal soul and I'm not going to be in this body forever. Tolerate. Like we have to tolerate the changing of seasons, sita usna, winter and summer. We have to tolerate it. Happiness and distress according to our fate, our karma, what we've done in this and previous lives, happiness and distress, they come to us. And we all want to live our only happy life. Just try. It's not possible. Because the forces of nature that insist upon mixing happiness and distress, they are more powerful than our desire. So Krishna is making a very practical point here, based on the philosophical point that we're eternal souls, that we have to learn how to tolerate comes to Tikshasvabharata, and I have one of my favorite Vrindavan pictures as an example of tolerate. The cow with the three crows on top of him. What to do? What to do? There he is, the cow, the calf just sitting there, and the crows say, "You're my seat." And the cow says, "No, I'm actually not your seat. I have my own plan of what I'm going to do for myself, with myself." But the crow says, "No, no, no, you're my seat." And this is how we look at each other. You all have a little part to play in my great plan to be unlimitedly happy in this world. And I have my little part to play in your drama. I have a little part to play. I'm not the hero. I'm not the hero, the star of the show. Abraham? John Abraham. Yeah? Yeah, he's good. I'm not the hero. In your drama, I'm the hero and I'm the central figure in my drama of my life, and the whole world should organize itself around what I want because I am the hero. And Krishna says, no. Actually, he says, I'm the hero. That's what he actually says. Aham savasya prabhavo mataksavam pavatateya. Everything comes from me. When universes can come from you, then you could be the hero. There's one time, this happened. This is actually, I heard this story like 30 years ago. There was a Sunday feast in Los Angeles. And the people who were coming, there were no Indian devotees at that time, 30, 35, maybe even 40 years ago. And the devotees made a big plate of prasadam, or boga, to offer to the deities. And there were sweets, there were the tastiest pakora, this, that, samosa was there, sabji, everything was there. And one devotee was carrying it to offer to the deities. And a guest was there. And he said, "What's that? Who's that for?" It was a silver plate with silver bowls and silver this and roses on it and everything. And the guest said, "Who is that for?" And the devotee said, "Oh, that's for the deity." And the guest said, "How long do you have to be here before you become a deity?" Because that's the way our mind works. We want things, everyone to serve us. And that's usually the problems when in marriage, especially the first 5 years or so, because the man has a dream of what his wife is supposed to be like. And then the Mataji has a dream of what her husband's going to be like, this, that, big muscles, unlimited money, or whatever. And then, for the first several years, there's such a tendency to be so much fighting because the wife is trying to make the husband into his dream, her dream, and the husband is trying to make the wife into his dream. It was actually funny, too, also, that we in Perth, we have a doctor that we go to. His name is Dr. Malik. He's from Agra. And Jagatrini Mataji, she went to see him. And he asked her to do something, take this test or something. So when she doesn't want to do something, she usually says, "Oh, my husband told me I shouldn't do that." So she said to Dr. Malik, "Oh, my husband said I shouldn't do that." And he said, "Why you shouldn't be like an Indian wife?" That's a joke. And it's a joke. It was a joke. You're supposed to laugh. The jokes. Because we weren't serious. We were just joking. So, tolerate and keep the consciousness fixed. Fixed in knowledge upon we're eternal and we have, what are we really trying to achieve in life? Next. Yam hina vyantantyete, everyone? purusham purusharthava samadukha sukham dhiram somrityat vaya kalpate. Now Jagatvini Mataji is going to speak on something about this, maybe even later today or tomorrow morning. So I'm not on this verse, but on a similar verse, Vitaragabaya Karudasa, I won't talk about it too much. But O best amongst, this is what Krishna is telling Arjuna, that if you can keep fixed, if you can keep focused in knowledge and keep your mind focused and tolerate the difficulties that must come in life, then you are certainly eligible for liberation. It takes such a deep focus on what is important and what is not important. A higher taste has to be there for the sweetness of that which is important. Okay, and then the last verse. Oh, there's... Oops. Oh yeah, one time Prabhupada. Because I see this with myself, that I become inspired, I read some shastra or something, or talk to some wonderful devotee and said, yes, from now on I'm going to get fixed and only be fixed in the absolute truth. And then something happens and I forget immediately. So many times, continuously. So one time Prabhupada was walking by the Pacific Ocean and he asked the devotees, why is the ocean peaceful? And Prabhupada, and no one answered. And Prabhupada said, because it is deep. Because it is deep. So if we want to actually be focused regardless of our fate and what happens to us according to our karma, we have to become deep. We have to become deep. And then this verse, I could have ended previously, but this is the last one. But there was a reason I wanted... This is a highly philosophical verse, but there was a particular reason why I wanted to just read this one. Please repeat after me. Nasato vidite bhavo. Nabhavo vidite sata. Ubayora drista antas. Tvanayas tatfadarshibi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. I always found this verse quite mysterious. But from what I understand, this is, in one sense, the essence of the whole Vedic culture. Is how they define things. They define something that doesn't exist. Something that doesn't exist, non-existence, is defined as temporary. Now that is such a heavy concept. Things that are temporary don't exist. What a definition. What a heavy definition. And those things that are eternal, those are the things that actually exist. So it's dividing reality into two distinct categories, those things that exist and those that are illusory and don't exist. And the things that are illusory and don't exist are those that are temporary. In other words, don't spend your valuable life just trying to make arrangements in the land of the temporary. Because you can't. And it's not worthwhile. It's like trying to go to sleep and dream the perfect dream. And why isn't that practical to devote your whole life to? why isn't it practical to devote your life to dreaming the perfect dream? Because you wake up. You will wake up. You must wake up, because it's only a dream. It doesn't really exist. But rather, Krishna is saying, that devote your life, and this isn't what he's saying at this point, but he's making this definition, that things that are eternal, in other words, your eternal existence, you, the soul, that is where you should place your energy. Okay. I don't think there's any more pictures after that. And there is a wise person, the sober person, Vidyavinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Ashkini, the learned person. He actually sees that in every body, regardless of the body that the soul is inhabiting, but within every body there is a soul, and this body's changed, but the soul is eternal. So that's learned. Learned means who has knowledge. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Prabhu, could you just open a little bit? Any questions? No, what did you? Yes. What's your name? What's your name? Yes.
Question is, my understanding was that the dream you are talking about, the very moment when we feel lusty, that means we are already dreaming.
We are
dreaming. We are starting to dream. So.
And your identification with the dream is so strong.
Yeah. So do you share that understanding, or? Do you have any comment on that?
When material attachment, because the Sanskrit word is kam, which means desire also. So when we are focused, when our consciousness becomes focused on our material desires, then we are not acting on the platform of knowledge, but we're acting on the dream platform. We've lost, because what knowledge does is, say if I accept that I'm not my body, I'm an eternal soul, but I have so many desires. Okay, but there is a space between myself and those desires, a space in my consciousness. I say, oh, I'm thinking right now that I want this and I want that, I want that, but I'm an eternal soul, so I'm still desiring something, but there's a space in the consciousness between the desire and me. But when one is captivated by one's desires, there's no space at all. One becomes one's mind, practically speaking. One becomes one's material desire. One becomes the dream, the illusion. And then one has to pay the results. One has to get the karma for that.
So, is it right to think that basically Bhagavad Gita is a book about how to stop dreaming? And about the mechanisms of dream.
And it also, yes. And it also tells you what is your real life. It starts telling you that, what your real life is. Your real life is your relationship with Krishna. That's the awakened position of the soul. And literally, Chaitanya Charitamrita means, Charita means activities. Is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu demonstrated in his life is the activities of the soul in the land of eternity. Now we see the activities of the soul in the land of the temporary, where we're identifying with the bodies. But what is the activity of the soul in eternity? That's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught. It means in relationship with Krishna. Okay? Good question. Anyone else have any questions? Yes. So we are all going to die. When you say we are all going to die, what do you mean is going to die? Okay. So, but we were just hearing that the soul, who is really you, is not going to die. So why did Krishna make something that's eternal? And the answer is, you don't make something that's eternal. Eternal means eternal. It's like, when did the sun create the sun rays? As soon as there is sun, there is sun rays. As soon as there's the sun, there's the sun rays. As soon as Krishna is there, the tiny jivas are there. So then the next question has been, how did we get into this situation of a material body? We turn our back on our relationship with Krishna. And the process of bhakti yoga is to go from bahirmukh to sammukh, from our back turned to Krishna and begin to face him again in our relationship with him, in our loving relationship with him. We want to develop love for Krishna. That is our natural relationship with Krishna. What do you think, Mataji? What do you really think? Or you want to think about it? But then the question is how to do it, how to awaken. Here I am with so many material desires, so much attachment to my body. How do I awaken my love for Krishna? So that's our whole process: chanting Hare Krishna, associating with devotees, kirtan, japa, serving. In other words, removing ourselves from the illusion that we're the center of the universe and become what we really are, start acting like we really are servants of Krishna. Easy to say, difficult to do. We have long bad habits. But if we chant sincerely and humbly, then Krishna will help. Do you have a question? Parabdha karma, which means the karma that we are coming to this world with. Parabdha. Yeah, that's what it means. And that is given to us by Krishna for a devotee. In the path of Jnanamarg, for jnanis, they have to keep their parabdha karma, the karma of this body. But for devotees, Krishna organizes what happens to us in such a way that assists our advancement. He doesn't give us exactly what we deserve. He gives us things in such a way that assist our advancement, even though it doesn't seem like it, like sometimes. Not exactly. He puts us through our karma. He takes our karma and gives us what he wants from it in such a way that we'll be benefited. That's his concern. Huh? So that we advance. Now, how long should we go until? Because Mataji still has to speak, and there's still other things. So, what? Why don't you please tell me what we should do? Because we'll have more time tomorrow, in a more regular day. So, should we end now? Or?
Yeah.